Today, I am delighted to be joined by Simon Yule, who is Head of Policy and Advocacy at Positive Money. Positive Money are a recent joiner to the DPF community, one of our new strategic partners. And given their focus on the potential for money to be used as a tool for improved social and economic policy delivery, we're really excited to have them as part of the conversation. And I'm really excited about this conversation with Simon today as well. As we'll see soon, Positive Money have done a lot of the very early thinking in the potential for CBDCs and new forms of digital money as well. So welcome, Simon. Would you like to introduce us and give us introduce yourself and give us a bit of background?
Sure. So yeah, I'm Simon Yule. I'm head of policy and advocacy at Positive Money. So I've been at Positive Money for over 6 years now. And Positive Money is an organization which started in the kind of aftermath of the 2008 crisis, focusing on how the money banking system works and how it got us into that mess and how it can be reformed. So originally a lot of the focus of our work was on, the question of where does money come from? Because, in the kind of textbook models, the descriptions were, quite inaccurate. They were saying, oh, banks just, take people's savings and lend them out to people. But, as, economists have, found over the years, and it never really made it into the neoclassical textbooks, banks were actually creating money when they make loans. So when a bank makes a loan, it creates both a new deposit and a new asset, which it receives in interest on. And we kind of argued, and people like Adair Turner echoed this, that one of the reasons which we had for why we had such a big financial crisis was banks were kind of unconstrained in their ability to create new money, and that led to them creating it for bidding up asset prices and using it irresponsibly to make short-term profits. But then, as we saw, because we kind of rely on banks to provide the means of payment in society, we had to bail them out when things went wrong. So yeah, we started in 2010, and over the years we've been kind of broadening out from that kind of original focus on, like, where does money come from, and how is it created and how is it distributed, to looking at various reforms that could improve the way the system works, like digital currencies, like having better macroeconomic policy, and also better financial regulation more generally. So yeah, we work on a range of different topics these days, housing, green finance and climate change, as well as topics like the digital pound, and new forms of money.
Thanks, Simon. And that point you raised there earlier, that banks don't take deposits and make loans as many people assume they do, rather they create deposits by making loans, is one that we've discussed and touched on many of our previous podcasts, and is explored in far more depth than the Bank of England's 2014 paper on money creation in the modern economy, for those who are interested in exploring the topic more. And I think that it's an incredibly important distinction to make, and one that has such a bearing on our understanding of public versus private money. And I was really interested to read some of Positive Money's earlier papers on central bank digital currency. So there was a paper on digital cash, which was written in 2016, and another one on money we trust in 2020. And these were 4 and 8 years old, respectively. And what's really fascinating is that many of the topics that are covered in them are still very fresh. They're still the topic of discussion and consultation in the Bank of England's recent discussion and consultation papers on the digital pound itself. So, can you tell us a little bit about those papers, their origins, what they were about, and what's changed over time as well? Because I know you've mentioned that your thinking on them has, on those topics, has evolved over the years as well.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, a lot of our early work was focused on improving kind of competition in payments. So we originally had proposals to allow payment providers to have access to central bank transaction accounts, which would enable them to settle payments. Because, as you and many of your listeners probably know, at the moment you kind of have to rely on the big clearing banks who have exclusive access to central bank settlement accounts to make payments. So if you want to compete with them and offer better payment services, you have to, go through the hurdles of becoming a bank, which, is very costly, and you need to be able to comply with lots of capital requirements and things like that. So our proposal was, to have, a kind of, narrow banking, as the term it often is used, approach, where, people could, payment firms could have access to central bank money, and, be able to offer payment services without needing to, comply with prudential regulation in the same way. So, but then there became a kind of, I guess, development amongst central bankers talking about, whether you could just have retail accounts at central bank. And this, is an idea that goes back a quite a long time. I think, it was discussed in the 90s at least, with the advent of kind of electronic money. And yeah, it's the idea of allowing citizens to have access to accounts at the central bank. So yeah, we published this paper in 2016, though it was like a kind of an idea that we'd been talking about in terms of an early proposal for a sovereign money system to have transaction accounts at the central bank, where people can make payments without needing a bank account. But essentially, yeah, it's kind of the core principle of, allowing people access to risk-free money at a central bank, which would enable the settlement of payments, without needing to essentially lend their income to a bank and expose themselves indirectly to credit risk. So, yeah, as you probably know, unless you're paid in cash, you have to essentially lend your income to a bank. And yeah, that gives banks huge amounts of power. There's an uncompetitive market for deposits, and yeah, banks we've seen are kind of don't use that privilege very well. So yeah, the kind of question that we were looking at was how do you kind of level the playing field and kind of democratize access to central bank money, which the public have in physical form in cash, but in a digital version. So that 2016 paper, I think was one of the first kind of civil society interventions in the debate around CBDC, as we now call it. And yeah, was making a positive case for how a central bank digital currency could improve stability and offer better kind of payment services to the public and better macroeconomic outcomes. And we followed that paper up in 2020 with a paper on called Money We Trust, basically, making the argument that kind of central bankers have increasingly had to refer to that kind of trust in money, in the kind of private forms of money that we use, like bank deposits, is anchored by the provision of public money. So I guess like one way you can kind of describe it is that there's separate layers of the money system where we have public forms of money, which are the ultimate foundation, and on top of that, private banks build up their, and issue their private forms of money. And we kind of trust that these private forms of money are worth the same as these, foundational public risk-free money because we're able to quite easily convert them between each other. But if we lose cash, which I don't think we should, I think we should keep cash for as long as people want to use it. But if cash becomes harder to access, it becomes harder to convert those forms of money. And particularly with other forms of digital money, like privately issued stable coins, you also need a kind of public anchor, which can be the key kind of foundation between all these other forms of money. So essentially, yeah, we our argument is that money is a public good. The public should have access to risk-free money issued by the government and shouldn't have to rely on a small handful of banks, to hold their money, who ultimately entangle the provision of payment services with credit risk. So, yeah, that's kind of our ultimate take on why we need public money. But we've kind of recognized, so in our original reports, the 2016 report on digital cash, which went on to inform the kind of platform model that the Bank of England has, where the Bank of England operates a core ledger, and then payment interface companies operate services based on that ledger, is an account-based system. And we kind of repeated that assumption in our 2020 paper as well, in which we actually argued there could be a case for an account-based system to bear interest, so that you could have a better control over monetary policy. While we still think an account-based system might be important, particularly for large transactions, we've kind of come to see increasingly that there is a strong case for a non-account-based form of CBDC, which the Bank of England hasn't really been looking at to its full extent at the moment, but would it essentially involve a bearer instrument model, kind of like cash, rather than payments and possession being authenticated by an account and identity linked to that account. It would be validated by possession of a token. So like in the same way, the cash in your wallet, physically it doesn't have any information that connects you to the instrument, but just the fact that you possess it is given enough that you can use it. So yeah, we've been exploring different models for this, and there's been interesting proposals like the eCash Act in the United States, which some Congress peoples have been putting forward, a kind of bearer instrument version, precisely because it's such a politically toxic issue around a central bank digital currency, where people are worried that having accounts at the central bank might impede upon their privacy and might mean that they are subject to surveillance from the state and other actors. So I think it's really important to offer a kind of offline version which isn't connected to any kind of account and can function like a true digital form of cash as a bearer instrument for people to trust and use it. Because I think in the UK we're seeing essentially, like people's biggest concern, or what they want to say when they have a consultation on CBDC, is they're worried about privacy. So I think the best way to do that, the Bank of England can make all these guarantees and the government can make all these guarantees, but the best way to do it is to make it in the technology itself, not relying on accounts, and being able to have a cash-like instrument, which what people benefit from today. And yeah, I think there are also other benefits to having a token-based system in terms of greater usability in situations where you can't access a network, which many parts of the UK are included in that. And yeah, allowing more efficient and cheaper transactions if you can settle peer to peer, which is what the original goal of Bitcoin was, to allow a peer to peer payment system, but it's since turned into something else. But yeah, I think peer to peer payments are a kind of holy grail of payments which haven't managed to be properly cracked yet, but I think a digital pound offers an opportunity to do that, especially if it is using kind of cryptography and token-based systems to implement.
There's a lot to unpack there, Simon. And I think, probably working in reverse order, one of the very important topics that you raised was obviously, one of the key functions of a digital pound would be a form of public money that continued to be accessible by the general public in an era of declining cash usage. But if that public money is to take a digital form, then digital inclusion is something that we need to consider as well.
Definitely.
Digital inclusion is incredibly complex. We live in a jurisdiction that doesn't consider the internet to be a public infrastructure. Some jurisdictions do, like I think Germany and South Korea are examples of two that do consider internet access to be public infrastructure and treat it as such. But unless if we're basically introducing a form of money that we expect to be accessible by the general public, then digital inclusion becomes a significant issue, as it does in any case already through greater delivery of public benefits and things like government benefits through the online government portal and things like that. And digital inclusion is not just about who has a mobile phone. It's about whether that mobile phone can be connected to the internet,
Yeah.
has reception at any point in time. And this is not just about, people living in rural areas. I mean, I live in Bermondsey in, SE1, 500 meters from Tower Bridge. And if I walk 10 meters outside my block of flats, I don't have mobile reception.
Yeah.
It's I think that whole argument around digital inclusion is an incredibly important national conversation that we need to have. And indeed, one of the challenges that we have in the introduction of a digital pound is that it's not part of a wider digital economy strategy or anything like that, which is why I guess, if we look at the digital euro, it has many challenges. But it has progressed to a far more advanced stage of planning than the digital pound has in the UK, partly because it is tied into a an EU-wide strategy around digital finance, transition to a digital economy. It's accompanied by plans for digital identity and things like that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, your point about, the internet being a public infrastructure, I think we should also recognize the monetary system as a public infrastructure, right? That I think, as I say, money is such an important public good. If we lose access to the ability to make payments, society basically ceases to function. And that's essentially why we had to bail out the banks, because we realized, if banks started failing, people wouldn't be able to make payments anymore in a digital economy. So yeah, I think it's super important we have a really robust system which doesn't require an internet connection, especially in an increasingly uncertain future where, we have potential cyber attacks, energy insecurity, and climate change and things like that. I think we really need to build the most robust system possible, which would be resilient to all those threats. And I think the best way of doing that is an offline capable system, which would have to be token based to be truly offline. And yeah, I have the exact same experience myself, even living in London. The amount of times I've not been able to pay for something because they're card only, and then there's a network problem. When festivals have tried to trial contact sorry cashless experiences, that it's always seems to be the case that something goes wrong, and then you can't buy a drink at a festival, which is, a big disadvantage for both the business and the consumer. So, yeah, I think, the current systems we have, need to be thought about more holistically. And I think, yeah, you're right. Like a kind of proper strategy on this is going to be crucial, because I think, yeah, as you suggest, you can't really disentangle financial inclusion from digital inclusion. And I think, yeah, we need to kind of deliver a final product to the public which is as simple and intuitive as possible. And I like to think, it should in theory be possible for someone, without needing any ID or anything to access, a kind of device, like whether it's like a small a smart card or something, which has a, a small amount of digital pound on it, which they can use to make transactions. This raises obviously a lot of questions about, economic crime, KYC, AML, etc. But I think we do actually have solutions for that, or at least opportunities to do those things in a better way. And I think, one thing that hasn't really been unpacked as much in its potential is, the potential for a kind of new way of doing things like AML and KYC, particularly AML and tax enforcement, is by having, kind of one-sided privacy where you're only looking at the kind of payee's income to do enforcement. You don't need to see what people are spending their money on, but you need to kind of see where they're getting their money from. And I think that would now enable people to pay for things with a digital pound, without worrying that, their data is going to be surveilled or analysed by someone. But retailers would still have to comply with being able to show, that all of the money they receive, where that comes from. So I think there's real opportunities there to reduce the huge costs of compliance with AML, things like that that aren't really being explored. I think we need to take a more imaginative approach to it and think about all these issues together, as you suggest, with a strategy where we are looking not only at the opportunity for a better payment system, but also better ways of doing all kinds of things with that new technology can enable.
And I think you'll be, now that we're partners as well, you'll be joining the DPF's Privacy and Identity Working Group, which is doing a lot of work on the future of AML and looking at topics like that. But you've touched on something else there as well, which is, when you talk about AML, it's very much wrapped up in the challenge of financial inclusion, the fact that when someone is onboarded to a bank or a financial institution, they have to go through a very standardized AML process, and this involves, producing some form of photographic nationally recognized ID, so a driver's license or a passport. This involves also producing proof of address in the form of three bills, things like that, council tax bills. It's a highly standardized process, and one that also makes a lot of assumptions implicitly about the life of the person who is going through the opening process. And to a great extent, our entire financial system in the UK relies on some very outdated assumptions about what the behavior of the population is, that you're going to, leave school somewhere between the ages of 16 and 19, that you're going to open a bank account, that you're going to get a national insurance number at that point, that you're, at some point in later life, you're going to buy a house together with someone else while you are in full-time permanent employment. And even for many people who are born in the UK, many of these assumptions don't hold true anymore. We're seeing the rise of the gig economy. We're seeing a more mobile workforce. We're seeing people in more insecure living conditions, particularly in a cost of living crisis. And that's before you look at, migrant populations, at immigrants who, the UK wants to attract, at refugees, the recent influx of Ukrainian refugees, for example. These are all people who are excluded at some point in the financial system from access to banking, to payment services, and, in the longer run, potentially to credits as well. And so I've often, said that when asked whether a CBDC is really going to deliver financial inclusion, a CBDC on its own doesn't deliver financial inclusion. It's not a Financial inclusion is not a technological challenge, it's a policy challenge. We have to overhaul the way we think about AML and KYC and the lives of the people who are involved. I think what you've been saying as well.
And this is something that's come up, in the roundtables we've had with the Treasury, where, we've tried to bring in civil society voices who represent, the marginalized and people, who aren't served by the current financial system. And the kind of the people being concerned by the way the Treasury has talked about the digital pound, that financial inclusion isn't a priority for it. That's kind of an afterthought. The obviously the main objectives of a digital pound are stability of the monetary system, but also innovation and payments. But financial inclusion is a kind of nice to have, thing tacked on to the end. So we've tried to been encouraging, the government and the Bank of England to think of this as a technology which could, or a new way of doing things which could enable greater financial inclusion. Because I think at the moment the approach has just been to leave it to the usual actors to deal with financial inclusion, i.e. the banks or other credit providers. And we've seen,
Which
that
they're
hasn't
not,
worked.
yes.
Yeah, like we, yeah, they haven't, and they have no incentive really, because at the end of the day, for a lot of these kind of people we're talking about who are on low incomes, they're not attractive customers. Christine Lagarde, I think, said it, like banks aren't exactly rushing out to meet these customers, and why would they? It is actually quite expensive for a bank to to provide services, and they had to be subsidized elsewhere in the business. So like the basic bank account was a great, I think, win for financial inclusion. But yeah, ultimately that is quite an expensive way of giving people access to payments in, you know, in the modern economy. And yeah, I'm hoping with, you know, a kind of digital pound, we could have a better alternative to that, and to enable people to access money in a digital economy without needing to go through those same requirements and hurdles, which, as you say, like expect people to live a pretty uniform life. And yeah, I think we should be embracing the opportunity to support, you know, a diversity of people and lifestyles and communities, being able to, you know, live and work in the ways that they want. And I think that's ultimately, you know, what hopefully a digital pound and monetary innovation can help us with, I'd hope.
And so, what are some of the other social and economic benefits that positive money sees as potentially being delivered by a well-designed digital BDC?
So a key one for me, which is rarely talked about, but I think I've talked about it to you before, is the seigniorage revenue from digital pounds. So, you know, the Bank of England used to make quite significant profits from banknotes, you know, several billions of pounds a year. This is because when they essentially sell banknotes to a bank, they take the money and invest them into government bonds, and then the profits from those government bonds are remitted to the Treasury. So essentially, the government was benefiting from several billions of pounds a year from note issuance. Obviously, with the decline of cash, that kind of seigniorage revenue, which, you know, is the profits from making money, have been transferred to banks. And a digital pound actually enables the government to kind of recapture some of that benefits from the issuing of public money that have been lost. So in the case of a digital pound, the Bank of England will be issuing new money, new liabilities, but it will be backing those liabilities with assets like government bonds. And essentially, the profits from those assets will be recycled back to the Treasury. New Economics Foundation did a study back in 2017, which suggested this would be, I think, around 8 or 9 billion pounds a year. I've done more recent kind of estimates, and because of a greater increase in deposits, but also higher interest rates, this could be in the region of 20 to 30 billion pounds a year, kind of cost savings from having a digital pound. So it's quite a difficult concept to get your head around, seigniorage. But yeah, essentially, it's the kind of profits from being able to issue money, and it could be potentially, you know, transformative for a government. You know, politicians are saying we can't afford 20 to 30 billion pounds a year of green investment, which is deemed necessary to save the planet. But I think governments, with the adoption of a digital pound, are going to be given a huge windfall from essentially lower borrowing costs, from, you know, their payments on bonds being recycled back to them via digital pound. And I think there's only a question about what can be done with that. And I think one way to spend that money is to invest it in a kind of national development bank, you know, which can either invest in projects directly to support a greener, fairer economy, lend to councils, which obviously we know need the money, particularly to invest, or just simply bond lend the money to other banks, particularly kind of stakeholder banks, which banks which serve communities, like mutual banks as well, which offer better models of banking. And yeah, I think therefore a digital pound in this way, by recycling the kind of profits from public money back to the public through these institutions, could enable a greener and more prosperous economy. And I think, you know, a lot of concern around a digital pound is focused on disintermediation, you know, banks losing their deposit funding as a kind of bad thing, right? Because then this could mean them providing less credit to the economy. But we've kind of flipped it on its head and said, actually, this could be an opportunity, because banks currently are pretty poor at allocating credit. They don't lend it to the real economy. They chase whatever, you know, offers the greatest return on equity to their shareholders, which is usually mortgages, which are kind of a zero-sum game economically. In the long run, there is no real benefit and can lead to huge amounts of inequality and potential financial instability. So yeah, actually, this could give us more of an opportunity to make sure the power to create money, which is, I guess, what power, positive money was focused on, kind of focusing on, was founded on focusing on, how we can make that more democratic and bring that into, the public realm to decide what we want to do with with these profits and yeah, how they can support the real economy. So I think there's really an opportunity for a bolder vision, and people have done this for the US, like Sol Yairmova, who was President Biden's original pick for Office of Comptroller of the Currency. People like Robert Hockett as well. I've worked on basically putting forward a kind of blueprint for how, if we did move to a kind of digital fiat currency, like a central bank digital currency, how this would actually be an opportunity to improve the financial system, not only in terms of financial inclusion, but also in terms of ensuring a flow of capital to productive development. So yeah, I'd be keen to try and explore and replicate that thinking in the UK. Because yeah, I think it's really exciting. And when people, ask, so how's the digital pound going to benefit me if you're not like kind of financial excluded and you don't see the kind of costs of the current system as a consumer, maybe this is one way to convince them, we could have a better economy, because we would be able to help shape the allocation of credit to, where it's needed.
That's super interesting because I think a lot of the, the public debates and the argument about the benefits of CBDC, aside from privacy, which is an ongoing topic, and let's not go in there too deeply because I think it's already discussed widely elsewhere. But for a lot of the public discussion focuses on the use case. So what is the point of, a CBDC? What will we use it for and things like that? And I mean, for me personally, when we think about CBDC, the reasons to think about CBDC are far wider than just how can it replace, payments use cases today. It's more about the geopolitical context. It's more about, the potential for as a platform for innovation. It's more about, global positioning and things like that. And I think what I'm really excited to be working with Positive Money on is looking at these, other potential ways in which the introduction of CBDC, new forms of digital money more generally, can help. Can help to change the allocation of priorities in the financial system so that they lead to better social and economic outcomes, which is I think what you're very much interested in as well. And more broadly, Positive Money is not about just about digital money. It's about how money in general can be used as a tool and deployed for better social and environmental outcomes. How about we finish off with you telling us a bit more about your broader work, and also, some of the other topic areas that you're looking at that are priorities at the moment?
Sure. Yeah. So I think, as I mentioned, we broadened out our work quite significantly from our original focus on, how banks create money and how that issue can be reformed at its heart. So we've gone on to look at, what are the other kind of impacts our money and banking system has, and the way in which banks allocate credit are causing social and even environmental harm. So we've done a lot of work on green finance. We were kind of pioneering some of the work, I'd say, around greening central banking, which has become a big topic at the time. Sorry, big topic recently. So we've been doing work around how the Bank of England's monetary and financial policies are essentially reinforcing the climate crisis and banks' kind of preference for lending to fossil fuels rather than renewables. So yeah, we've looked at ways in which you could use Bank of England tools in a way which could actually support a greener economy. We've also looked at housing in recent years. So obviously, as we talk about the way in which banks predominantly lend to mortgages, that means that you have a huge amount of new credit bidding up prices of a finite supply of houses. And we've looked at how the transformation of housing into an asset via the banking system has led to poor outcomes for everyone, even homeowners themselves, who even if their house appreciates in value, they it isn't really much of a benefit to them if they still need to live somewhere. So the only people who really benefit from the system are people who own multiple properties. So yeah, that's another area, and a kind of a bigger area as well, I would say, is more about the kind of macroeconomic coordination. And so this has become, I guess, increasingly relevant with the way we're, responding to issues like inflation by using interest rates, raising the price of money in a way which is quite inefficient and doesn't actually deal with the causes of inflation. So we kind of have a perverse system where we're trying to deal with inflation by raising the cost of living for, a small handful of mortgage holders, and hoping that will, kind of immiserating them will, cool demand in the economy and cause inflation to go lower. But when, the kind of research we've done emphasizes that inflation is particularly driven by supply side factors like, supply chain disruption and, climate change causing unstable kind of harvest and those associated issues. And, we think there needs to be a better kind of strategy to deal with the kind of macroeconomic consequences of these issues, involving not only the Bank of England and interest rates, but also where democratically elected governments can be more active in fiscal policy as well, not just leading it to the Bank of England, because as we saw in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis, the focus on the Bank of England and QE, quantitative easing to stimulate the economy as well, also just didn't really do much for the real economy, but increased inequality and kind of set us up for the kind of financial instability we're seeing, what we've seen in re more recent years, when suddenly you have to raise interest rates, where after having them low for a very long time, and then that suddenly causing the I guess a house of cards that have been built up from QE and low interest rates to suddenly collapse. So yeah, we think there are potentially better ways in which you can deal with the economic problems of today than the traditional tools used by the Bank of England.
Thanks, Simon. It's been absolutely fascinating having you on today. I'm sure we could have spoken for much longer, and the last few topics that you raised, I'm sure that each of them is worth a deep dive themselves. But very much looking forward to working with you on exploring more some of these topics in more depth through our partnership between Positive Money and the Digital Pound Foundation.
Great,
For
thank
coming
you.
on today.